All right, welcome back. I'm here today with activist, filmmaker, artist, writer, editor, and all-around troublemaker, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. Hi, Matilda.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good. Can you give us a little more info about yourself?
Sure. What would you like to know?
Maybe how you first got involved in queer organizing.
Sure. Well, I first got involved in queer organizing, I think, when I moved to San Francisco in 1992. And I was 19, and, you know, I was radical politically already in most ways and queer, and moving to San Francisco in order to sort of find new ways of looking at the world and new definitions of culture and community and activism and challenging the status quo. And so, of course, one of the first things I did when I moved to San Francisco was to join ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. You know, which was the AIDS activist group. And that particular ACT UP in San Francisco was very focused on four things. One was needle exchange, one was women with HIV, one was prisoners with HIV, and the other was universal health care.
Okay.
And so its politic was that you couldn't fight AIDS unless you were also fighting racism and classism and homophobia and misogyny, like sort of all at once. And so that was really formative for my politics, you know, as a radical, like, anti-assimilationist queer coming of age, you know, in the early 90s. That was sort of the beginning for me.
And you've been pretty outspoken about the current state of mainstream gay organizing. I'm thinking of, like, your interviews on NPR about gay marriage and Democracy Now! On the issue of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So can you talk a little bit about what you find so problematic on what's touted as mainstream gay issues?
Sure. Well, see, if we look at the sort of mainstream gay agenda, what do we see? We see, you know, the central issues that are supposed to be important to us, you know, are marriage, military, child rearing and adoption, and maybe ordination into the priesthood, right? So it's all of the sort of grossest aspects of, you know, dominant straight culture are suddenly supposed to be, you know, the dominant concern for all queers. And I think, especially if we look at marriage and military, I mean, arguably adoption and child rearing, you know, could be a positive thing. But, you know, the military, I mean, especially here in the U.S., I mean, if we have to think about one institution that's causing more harm in the entire world than any other, there would have to be the U.S. military. And, you know, if we want structural change, we have to be fighting for the end of the U.S. military, or at the very least, the end of, you know, U.S. colonial imperialist incursions all over the world, you know, plundering indigenous resources and making the whole world unsafe for anyone, you know, who isn't, you know, a corporate profiteer. And then marriage, of course, you know, it's a failed institution. I mean, most straight people know that. And not only that, but it's, you know, has been and continues to be, you know, a central place for anti-woman, anti-queer, and anti-trans violence. And so we shouldn't be fighting for inclusion within this hideous institution. We should be fighting for the end of it. And to me, those are just basic, you know, queer values. I mean, if we look at early gay liberation, I mean, what did gay liberation start? You know, it was a fight against police brutality. It was a fight against, you know, police control of queer lives. And early gay liberation, you know, arguments were for an end to marriage, an end to the nuclear family, an end to organized religion, and, you know, an end to the tyranny of all, you know, forms of oppression, you know, both in day-to-day lives and around the world. And the sort of mainstream gay movement now, it's really all about obtaining straight privilege instead of challenging power. And I think we need to get back to challenging power.
And in your interview with Jason Ruiz for the Radical History Review, you used the term violence of assimilation. Can you expand on how that reality gets enacted on queer people's lives and bodies?
Absolutely. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, anti-assimilationist queers, we're told, oh, you know, we have to, you know, get back to fighting the real issue, you know, which is homophobic violence. And I think if we look at, you know, this sort of gay assimilationist agenda, what it is really is, you know, it is an agenda of, you know, cultural erasure and policing the borders. And to give just a few examples, you know, the perfect place, I think, for example, is San Francisco, where I did live for a long time. And San Francisco, of course, you know, is the place in the U.S. where, you know, mainstream gay people have actually succeeded at their goals of becoming part of the power structure.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so we take a look, well, what happens when gay people, you know, actually get some of this power? And so we look at the Castro, the sort of mythic wealthy gay neighborhood, and we have gay bar owners who arrest homeless queers because they get in the way of happy hour. We have property owners in the Castro who make sure that, you know, queer youth of color are kept out of the neighborhood because it might interfere with property values, community property values, of course, is what they say.
Right.
You know, we have a Zephyr Realty, a realty firm that for a while was famous for a gay-owned realty firm
mm-hmm.
that was famous for advising its clients on how best to evict people with AIDS in order to get more for the property. And we also have, you know, pro-development, anti-poor political consultants mm-hmm. over and over again who are gay political consultants who are responsible for the election of, you know, the same kind of like corporate agenda kind of mayoral campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we look, you know, nationwide and even internationally, you know, at gay neighborhoods, you know, it's tragic in a way because I think gay neighborhoods emerged especially in the 1970s, 60s, mm-hmm. 70s, and 80s, because gay people, you know, didn't have a place where they could express themselves,
mm-hmm.
express their, you know, gender, social, sexual identities.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they created these neighborhoods where they could feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so tragic is that over and over and over again, these gayborhoods now have become, you know, wealthy, affluent places only really for people, you know, the white, wealthy, affluent, and male, or other people who are willing or able to sort of, you know, succumb or pass in those sort of white middle-class norms.
Mm-hmm.
And over again, we see, like, gay neighborhoods spearheading the sort of ethnic cleansing and the gentrification of the entire areas, you know, arresting trans women, arresting sex workers,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting rid of people of color, and making the whole, you know, the whole world, you know, safe, in quotation marks, for, you know, consumerism and mindless adherence to sort of, like, the grossest, you know, aspects of consumer norms. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, oh, we can sip our Grey Goose, you know, Cosmotinis in safety while, you know, getting rid of the people who are originally in this neighborhood and calling it ours.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that rhetoric of community which is so tragic to me
mm-hmm.
because, you know, those people who moved to gay neighborhoods in the 60s and 70s and 80s
mm-hmm.
and even now
mm-hmm.
could actually create a safe place for, you know, all different kinds of communities
mm-hmm.
or community building.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like just take, you know, someone who bought a house in the 60s and probably didn't spend that much money on it and then renovated it and made it a beautiful place. Now, say, you know, in many of these gay neighborhoods, those houses are worth $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, you know, and people should, I mean, it'd be wonderful if people with those $1 million houses would, you know, perhaps create a safe place for, you know, homeless queer youth to
mm-hmm.
sleep every once in a while,
mm-hmm.
or even just to come in for a free meal, or even like, you know, to serve, you know, some of the sex workers in the neighborhood some hot coffee or tea, right? Just small gestures of community
mm-hmm.
are completely absent from
mm-hmm.
these neighborhoods. They're all, you know, they've become just a place to buy overpriced cocktails
mm-hmm.
and, you know, find the latest tacky fashion.
So this week is Pride Week here in Kingston. How have you seen Pride events in your own experience both challenge and adhere to this violence of assimilation?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think I've ever seen Pride events challenge the violence of assimilation.
Okay.
I feel like Pride is sort of the sort of symbolic centerpiece of assimilation in
mm-hmm.
a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, obviously, again, it's the same thing. I mean, Pride started to commemorate the Stonewall riots,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now all it is just a, you know, it's an, I mean, many, definitely the larger cities in the U.S., Pride is gated, first of all, so
right.
you can only participate if you're part of a, you know, a contingent.
Right.
And, you know, it's just an endless place for target marketing for the, you know, just hideous companies to, like, win the consumer loyalty of gay people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know, I think the thing about Pride is it sort of, in some ways, masks, you know, the sort of vapidness of its agenda by, you know, you see, like, the endless parade of, like, every, you know, gay or LGBT nonprofit, you know, in the city. And so you're like, oh, look at all these different kinds of people. But what are they marching for? Nothing, right? It's just a, you know, a spectacle to promote, you know, I don't know, Altoids or Budweiser or even Coors now. I mean, the ultimate irony is this sort of symbolic, like, right-wing company that was boycotted for years by gay people is now the sponsor of many Pride parades. You know, and I think the pinnacle for me, you know, was in San Francisco in 2003 when the advertising slogan of Budweiser became the official Pride slogan. So, you know, Budweiser says, be yourself, make it a Bud. And San Francisco Pride said, be yourself, change the world. You know, and so every time you drink Budweiser, especially when you pay $8 for it, you're changing the world.
Now, something that kind of swept the media, I guess, in the last year or maybe half year or so is the It Gets Better campaign, and kind of erupted with both celebrities and non-celebrities making their own versions. What do you make of this campaign and the focus on youth and bullying?
Right. Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting because it was like suddenly the media, the mainstream corporate media, had discovered this, you know, I mean, the way they framed it is there's this new problem of, you know, queer teen suicide.
Right.
And I mean, obviously, this has been going on for generations.
Right.
I mean, you know, gay people, queers, you know, young trans kids have been killing themselves forever, you know, because of systemic, you know, structural and familial homophobia and anti-trans violence. And I mean, it gets better in a way. There's a well-meaning side to it, but I find it tragic to tell kids, you know, someone who's considering suicide, you know, let's say they're 15 or something, and the whole message is it gets better once you get away, but you're not there yet. What about making it better, you know, in queer lives today? You know, what about changing, you know, creating safe ways for queer kids to get out of abusive families, you know, to get away from, you know, abusive schools, not telling people just to stay there, you know, just stay there while your parents are beating you, while your uncle might be raping you, while you're getting abused and bullied at school every day. Just wait it out and it's all going to get better. And I also think it's not true, necessarily. Right. You know, I think sometimes it gets worse. You know, I mean, why, you know, and I mean, for me, and of course, there's such a wide range, you know, of videos that people have recorded, so some of them are kind of touching and, you know, intimate, and some of them are, you know, just straight celebrities, you know, looking for a new audience. But, so, you know, so I think there's an element, I mean, it's nice that people want to challenge, you know, the violence that's, you know, that queer kids are surviving every day. But I don't think it's not working to systemically change anything.
Do you have any suggestions or advice, I guess, for young radical queer and trans folks who are attempting to also challenge ideas of assimilation and making spaces for themselves?
Well, I don't know. I think it's always good to get the hell away from where you started. Honestly, I mean, that's my personal experience. I mean, not everyone, you know, has that opportunity necessarily. But, you know, if you're, you know, I think, you know, finding ways to sort of, you know, remake ourselves over and over again is always really important. And I don't know, I mean, I wish, you know, just speaking of those sort of larger communal norms, I wish that, like, queer kids were actually embraced. I mean, there's nowhere less friendly to queer kids than, like, mainstream gay spaces. I mean, you know, and queer kids are often simultaneously used, like, either as, you know, sexual objects or, you know, instant gratification, and abused by the gay people who should be making their lives safer. And I think that, to me, is the ultimate tragedy. And I think also, you know, that It Gets Better kind of obscures that in a way by, you know, acting as if like, sure, a few people might say, you know, you might have Google or something, like gay people at Google making a little video talking about, you know, how it's going to get better, you know, one day you can work at Google. Mm-hmm. I mean, which might be true for a few people. But, I mean, I think it just obscures the reality of what's really going on. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, queer kids, you know, as you're asking, I think the most important thing to me is always the question. And I think there's so much, in a way, you know, like I came out in the early 90s, and I think there was a lot more obvious, like, structural and systemic violence. You know, people were dying everywhere of AIDS. Mm-hmm. You know, like, homophobia was in many ways more obvious. Mm-hmm. But I think in some ways it was a better time, you know, to come out, because you could come out into a culture of opposition. You knew that you weren't welcome. And now there's such... I mean, obviously many queer kids know they're not welcome, but there's also such a rhetoric of inclusion that actually doesn't bother including anyone. I mean, maybe it includes Ellen DeGeneres, you know, or maybe it's going to include David Geffen or Rosie O'Donnell. Mm-hmm. But most people aren't, you know, Ellen DeGeneres or Rosie O'Donnell or David Geffen, and don't want to be, you know. And so I think the sort of rhetoric around of inclusion actually, you know, and, you know, these hideous gay TV shows or, like, you know, whatever gay celebrity of the moment actually in some ways narrows the options for everyone. Mm-hmm. Because now we're supposed to, before we were just freaks and outsiders and, you know, queers, and we were doomed to a life of hideous despair. But now we're supposed to be like Ellen, and which gives you more freedom, you know? And I think, I guess for me, the important thing is always to sort of, like, fight for the lives of the people who are most marginalized, not the people with the most privilege. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what, I mean, what we're told now is that the people with the most privilege matter the most, you know? So things like tax breaks and inheritance rights, which for, you know, rich white gay people with, you know, stock portfolios and hedge funds and new trimming every now and then, you know, those are the last, you know, those are their last things that, you know, that they need. They'll say, I mean, you know, and, but really, well, they'll say they're the first things they need, rather, and, or the last, you know, items that are, you know, on their checklist. But for most people, you know, those are things that aren't going to change their lives. So, you know, if you're, you know, a trans kid who's run away from an abusive home and strung out on drugs, living on the street, and engaging in survival sex to make a living, and someone says, oh, well, you know, if you could get married, then you get tax breaks and inheritance rights. You know, it's like we actually need to get back to talking about the things that matter the most, you know, housing and health care and sexual liberation and, you know, freedom of expression and, you know, the ability to create, sustain, you know, change and transform our gender, sexual, social identities, you know, those are the things we need to be talking about, you know, and I think that's what matters to queer kids, that's what matters to queer adults, that's what matters to queer elders, you know, that's what matters to the most people. And it's all of that has been lost in the sort of, like, mainstream gay, you know, fixation on marriage and military, you know, at the cost of everything else.
And often when critiques like yours are brought up, the response is, I mean, you talked about this earlier, like accusations of dividing the queer community, that in the face of so much homophobia, queerphobia, and transphobia, we should be sticking together instead of being critical of each other. What would you say to those critiques?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say there is no monolithic, you know, gay, LGBT, or queer community. And so what we're doing is actually voicing the divides that already exist. And I think the illusion, you know, of this monolithic community is actually, you know, it's a sort of kind of violence that gay people with power sort of hide behind in order to oppress everyone else and get away with it, you know. And so we're not creating divisions that don't already exist. And I think nothing is ever going to change unless, personally, I think we need to further that divide. You know, I think that's a much more valuable, like, contribution than, you know, creating this sort of shiny gay, you know, sweatshop-produced rainbow flag and like pulling it up at every event and saying, mm-hmm. you know, we're all in this together, because we're not. Mm-hmm. And I wish that wealthy gay people were actually making the world safer for other queers, but they're not. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, there are exceptions here and there, but they're so rare it's hard to even give an example. Yeah, I mean, I think there's no potential for fighting homophobia or anti-trans violence or without actually, you know, talking about the divisions that actually exist. Mm-hmm. You know, who gets bashed on the street? You know, who gets sent to prison, you know, mm-hmm. because they don't have anywhere to live? Mm-hmm. While I think there is some truth to the fact that homophobic violence, anti-trans violence affects all queers, mm-hmm. it's unfortunate that all queers, I mean, that some queers are actually engaged in that violence mm-hmm. as the perpetrators, not, you know, the people who are, you know, being bashed.
Mm-hmm. And I saw on your website that you have a new anthology coming out next year. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It's true, yes. So my new anthology is called Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? And I know it's a question everyone's been asking. The subtitle is Flaming Challenges to Masculinity, Objectification, and the Desire to Conform. Mm. And in some ways, it kind of continues the analysis in my previous two anthologies. Mm-hmm. That's Revolting, Queer Strategies for Resisting Assimilation, sort of gathered together anti-assimilationist queer, you know, stories and struggles mm-hmm. in order to, you know, have some sort of intervention in the stranglehold of the, you know, mainstream gay agenda on gay and straight, you know, visions of queerness. Mm-hmm. And then Nobody Passes, Rejecting the Rules of Gender and Conformity, sort of talked about passing charades, you know, that everyone, you know, what does it mean, you know, to pass as, you know, queer or anti-capitalist or, you know, all, as well as the things that people usually talk about in terms of passing, you know, race, mm-hmm. class, gender, mm-hmm. you know, sexuality, age, ability. And the newest anthology, Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots, I mean, in some ways, each anthology for me is a personal intervention mm-hmm. as well as a communal and political intervention. Mm-hmm. And so that's Revolting, you know, I put together because I didn't see anything, you know, that came close to, like, representing the, you know, incredibly inspiring challenges to the status quo that I saw all around me in terms mm-hmm. of queerness. Mm-hmm. And Nobody Passes, you know, came about because I sort of wanted to extend that analysis to talk about, you know, the violence of passing, like who gets harmed, you know, just so someone else can belong. And Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? You know, I think in my life, I'm really inspired by sort of like radical queer and trans cultures. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, as a faggot, you know, but the sexual cultures that I inhabit are not the same as the political, cultural, and communal, you know, cultures that sustain me. Mm-hmm. And I think there's, you know, gay male sexual culture is such a hideous disaster area of, you know, like unquestioning adherence to, like, the grossest, you know, types of mainstream norms, you mm-hmm. know, whether it be, like, hyper-masculinity mm-hmm. or unquestioning consumerism. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question for me, you know, if the desire, the sexual desire, you know, that I have, you know, held dear for my life, you know, mm-hmm. you know, as a fag and as a queen and as a genderqueer mm-hmm. Freak, you know, if that desire is supposedly, I think it's where a lot of this started, right? Mm-hmm. Then why do I find myself in this sexual culture that just mimics everything that I hate? Mm-hmm. And so in some ways it's, you know, it's an intervention, an emergency intervention, I guess I would call it. Mm-hmm. Like, how, isn't it time, we need to imagine something else.
Right.
You know, we need to challenge the violence around us, and we need to look at where we've succeeded and failed, you know, where we've desired and where we've fallen apart, right? Mm-hmm. and try to imagine something else. So, and it comes out, yeah, on Valentine's Day, so it'll be the perfect romantic gift. for all of your loved and hated ones.
That sounds good. Where can people find out more information on you, on your books?
Sure. Well, I guess the easiest place would probably be my homepage, which is, it's my name, so MatildaBernsteinSycamore.com. Mm-hmm. And if you actually just search Matilda with two T's, MATTILDA, mm-hmm. it's usually the first thing that comes up.
Okay.
And then, yeah, that's probably the easiest place just to look for everything. I mean, the books, you know, should be available. I would say harass your local bookstores if they're not there. and, you know, of course, you can get them directly from the publishers or online. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, definite harassment of local bookstores is always important.
And you have a blog as well, Nobody Passes, is that right?
Exactly. My blog is nobodypasses.blogspot.com. And that's also linked from my homepage.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I can't let you go without any music requests, though.
Oh, music requests. Let's see. How about some... this is called Body Drummin' with an apostrophe at the end.
Body Drummin',
okay. And the name of the artist is Afefe, A-F-E-F-E.
Okay.
Iku, I-K-U.
Okay. I will try. Thanks again.
Yeah, absolutely.